Good morning, and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Marisa DeMarco, a reporter here at the station until just a couple of months ago. Now I'm the editor-in-chief of Source New Mexico, a nonprofit collaborative newsroom. I'm joined in the studio today by co-host Sean Griswold, a reporter with Source New Mexico. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
We're here to bring more attention and focus to the long-standing tragedy of missing and murdered Indigenous women and relatives in this region.
Today we'll hear from a family working to navigate the police systems to find their missing sister, advocates who can discuss new federal laws meant to help families and pointing out flaws that need to be addressed. We'll also talk with the Navajo Nation Police Chief to discuss how the web of law enforcement jurisdictions complicates investigations for his officers. Are you an Indigenous person in New Mexico with a relative that has gone missing or who was killed but the case remains unsolved? Or do you have friends and family members who are experiencing this? Do you have information to share about a missing loved one that you'd like to get on the air? Do you think law enforcement had an appropriate response to your family's concerns? Give us a call this morning at 277-5866. You can also email letstalk@kunm.org or tweet with the hashtag #letstalknm.
And a quick content warning, this show will seek to understand the historical traumas Native Americans experience every day. We're talking about heavy topics. If you're tuned in right now with younger folks or this isn't a good time to hear about those issues and you'd rather check in later, we'll post the full audio of this show at KUNM.org and SourceNM.com. We also have resources there, ways you can reach out for help if you're looking for someone or if this conversation brings up tough feelings.
Shelda Livingston is with us this morning. Her sister, Pepita Redhair, was last seen in March 2020 at her home in Albuquerque. Pepita's family is from Crown Point, New Mexico, and routinely travels to the city looking for her. Thanks for being here with us this morning, Shelda.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And tell us about the last time you heard from Pepita.
The last time we heard from Pepita was March 24, 2020. She didn't contact us within 2 days, and my mom got worried. Our mom got worried, and we reported her missing March 27, 2020. She still has not come home.
Okay. And would you explain the impact COVID-19 had on the police investigation?
Yes, with the pandemic, with the early pandemic onset, we asked for Nick, her boyfriend at the time was Nicholas, and we asked him to investigate, and they told us because of COVID, there was early pandemic restrictions, so therefore there was no investigation. We feel like there was no investigation done or completed or even started.
And you've said this, and police also mentioned this, that your sister had a history of domestic violence with her partner, and you mentioned he hasn't been questioned, or has he been arrested?
No.
So do you think the focus on the history of domestic violence affected how seriously police investigated your sister's case?
Yes, I did reach out to the officers numerous times, and they kept telling me, she'll come up, and that was the response I got from them, from Albuquerque Department.
And do you think that she was discriminated against because of her background?
Yes, I do, because their response to us was, she'll come up. She still hasn't come home yet. I mean.
Okay. And Pepita's case was recently added to this new cold case unit by the Bernalillo County District Attorney. How has that helped your family in trying to find her?
It's helping us in a way to bring out awareness and to get her story out there. It feels like it's only the beginning because last year not much was done. So now it's finally being open and it's finally being, you know, talked about. And then we feel like the investigation is finally starting for her.
Okay, and talk a little bit more about Pepita, and would you mind explaining to us why your family, you know, believes that Pepita didn't run away on her own?
Yes, my sister was in an abusive relationship with her boyfriend, and we believe she is a victim of domestic violence. and Pepita was beaten before she went missing. She always calls home. It's not like Pepita not to call home, not to come home. She always reached out to us. So we know something happened. We know if a relative does, this is out of the ordinary for her. So that's why we believe something has happened to her. So.
Okay. And have you talked with other families dealing with these same type of issues? And what do you share with one another when you do talk?
Yes, I do. I did reach out to Tamika Platero's family. I reached out to the mother, and she comes from the same area where my sister's from, where we come from in Crown Point. Her daughter went missing in 2019, and then all I do is encourage her to continue to keep the word out, continue to share her story, because 2019 is a long time. It's longer than Pepita. So you know this is an ongoing situation for missing, murdered Indigenous people, that it's not being investigated. Nothing, not much is being done for us.
Shelda, I'm sure you're thinking about this every day, and I imagine that it is really hard. But can you describe your sister a little bit? Can you talk about your relationship?
Yes, our sister is very outgoing. She always contacts us on a daily basis. She would call and say, oh, I'm doing this today. She always took pictures of herself. She loves skateboarding. She was planning to go back to school, and she has a room back home, and she was planning to come back and start going to the community college. And she's very outgoing, always talking, always making us happy, laugh. She always spoke out. She always reached out to her niece, Talisha, and she's taking it really hard.
Yeah.
To this day. And she always texts her, and the last text that she got was March 24th, and she still waits for her auntie to text.
Oh, and it's so hard.
Yeah, she was a mama's daughter. She was a mama's girl. And my mom always waits by the phone, waits for her to call and come home. She always reaches out to me, and if she needed help or anything, she always, this is not like her. She always calls and comes home one way or the other.
Is there any information that it would like help to share on the air in case anybody's seen her or anybody, you know, might be thinking that they can help search for her?
Yes. If you guys have, if anyone has any information, please do contact us. I am the eldest of the family. If you guys could call my phone number, 505-219-5559, with any additional information that could help us lead to her, that would be greatly appreciated.
And so your family has done a lot of the searching for her, right? You come to Albuquerque and look. You're actively looking for Pepita Redhair.
Oh, yes. We're continuing to put out flyers. We're continuing to walk up and down Central. We reach out to little the shelters. We continue to pass out flyers as much as we can. We just started working with Darlene Gomez to get the word out, to bring awareness out for MMIW. Recently, we just did a rally with Kara Plummer and Alicia Rodriguez with their grandmother, Priscilla. They also reached out to a lot of other families to come and join us for the rally. And that's when everything came in place for us to bring the awareness out for what's happening to our people.
Shelda, do you have any words to share with families who are struggling with these issues but have yet to reach out or have given up seeking support?
Yes, don't give up. Continue to search. There are resources out there. If anything, reach out to Darlene Gomez. She is a resource of a lot of things. families out there, please don't give up on your loved one. They deserve to come home.
So we have Darlene today. She's with the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives Task Force. So she's going to be on with you too this morning, Shelda. I'll let Sean introduce her.
All right. And thanks for sharing with that with us, Shelda. Darlene Gomez is an attorney, member of New Mexico's Missing, Murdered, and Indigenous Women and Relatives Task Force. She's also an advocate for families, including Pepita Red Hairs. Good morning, Darlene.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us. So if you could just discuss a little bit about what it is that you do and how you started working with Pepita Red Hairs family.
So I am an attorney. I've been practicing for 18 years. I started working on MMIW as a legal intern at the district attorney's office in Farmington. That was my very first case. That was Betty Lee. And that was back in 2002. And since that time, I have assisted other families in getting the word out. I think as far as Pepita's family, I was able to see their post, and I really felt compelled to be able to use my resources to help them. Not only do I help Pepita Red Hair, I also help LMA Begay, Jamie Yazzie, and Kayleen Wounded Face.
Okay. And what would you explain a little bit about what it is that you provide for them in terms of resources and to the support that you're able to provide for these families?
I think, first of all, it's just telling them that that I care and that we need to get together and come up with a plan. That plan is to, if there's a rally already coming up, to make sure that we have the right speakers there, that we incorporate law enforcement, governors from different pueblos or tribal leadership, that we also do press releases and in hopes of getting national media attention. One of the biggest parts is trying to get the family ready for interviews and to really work with them to have their voices heard, because it's not me being their advocate. It's just me helping them have a voice and continue that voice throughout, whether it be Navajo Nation, the state of New Mexico, the FBI. So that's where we start off. We have a very calculated plan when we start searching for MMIW victims, and the sooner I get the case, the more I can do, because oftentimes I won't get a case until a year later. With LMA Begay, her case is fairly new. It's four months old.
Shelda, you're still here with us. Can you talk a little bit about what the work Darlene is doing? What has that meant for your family?
We are very appreciated that she became part of it. So it did bring a lot of families together with the rally. The rally's the one that really put it out there for us. We're thankful for Darlene and Kara and Alicia and Priscilla that assisted with the whole rally. Me and my mother originally just planned for the walk and pass out flyers, but it became more than that when they stepped in. So that was very good for other families to come and join us. Not only that, we got other speakers to come and tell their stories to bring awareness to.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate that that sharing that information for us there. Darlene, just one other quick question. You mentioned that you're working on four cases. Are all of these still active cases, active investigations?
So three out of the four are active investigations. The fourth case, Kayleen Wounded Face, took place on the Navajo Nation. She went missing. Her body was found in a burnt car, and the family's case was closed by both FBI and Navajo Nation, saying that they couldn't determine the cause of death. So for me, that's a case I'm trying to reopen, because this Kayleen did have a domestic violence history, and the family was told, well, maybe she was just driving on the Mesa in a low gear and her car caught on fire. To me, that is not a feasible story, and this case should have been investigated more.
Okay, Darlene, stick around with us. We have more questions for you. We do have to go to a break. We're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women and relatives cases in New Mexico today. Are you an Indigenous person looking for a missing relative? Give us a call with that information this morning, 277-5866.
Or are you seeking justice for a family member who is killed? How has this affected your family's well-being? Do you have a story to share about a loved one that is missing? Give us a call at 277-5866. Tweet us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the New Mexico Philharmonic. Violinist Rachel Barton Pine returns as soloist in the Sibelius Violin Concerto, 6 p.m. Saturday the 23rd at Popejoy Hall. Also Dvorak Symphony No. 8. Tickets at nmphil.org.
Support comes from Canteen Brewhouse. Locally brewed beer, cider, and root beer. Growlers, crowlers, six-packs, and an expanded food menu are available. Open at noon, 7 days a week. CanteenBrewhouse.com.
Spanish composer Manuel Palau wrote this extraordinary piece in 1947, but until a few months ago, it had never been played outside of Spain. We've got a rare performance of the Concierto Levantino by Manuel Palau on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Sean Griswold, a reporter with Source New Mexico, and I'm here with my co-host, Marisa DeMarco, editor of Source New Mexico.
We just want to let everyone know that we're talking about historical trauma Native Americans face every day. We're learning about relatives that have gone missing or who've been killed. If this isn't a good time for you to hear about those issues, or maybe you've got younger folks nearby and you'd like to check in later, the full audio of this show will be posted to KUNM.org.
All right. And Darlene Gomez is an attorney and member of New Mexico's MMIWR task force. I want to bring her back and ask you a question, Darlene. What are the issues you see when coordinating information between tribal, city, state, and local police jurisdictions?
There is a tremendous amount of issues when it comes to that, especially when it is a missing murdered Indigenous woman who is missing from a reservation, because then you have tribal police, and then you have a criminal investigator, and then you have the FBI. So I think it's critical that the first officer on the scene who takes the report and who collects evidence, it's really important that that portion is done correctly. I think sometimes it would be very helpful to call in the FBI immediately because they have more resources. They're able to collect evidence in a safer manner. That is really one of the issues. And I think we need to talk about the funds and the dollars that go into law enforcement. That needs to really be a priority for states and for the federal government, because all these officers are understaffed. Okay. We have issues with evidence that needs to be tested and should be tested immediately. I've been told that sometimes the evidence can sit at Quantico for 2, 3, 4 years, and that's not acceptable because these families deserve justice now. They need to have answers. They need to have some type of closure.
All right. And so we're joined now by the Navajo Nation Police Chief, Philip Francisco, a retired Army officer. Chief Francisco has served more than 5 years in his role in the Navajo Nation. Good morning, Chief Francisco.
Good morning.
So let's start off. Why don't you discuss the structure of your police department and also discuss what kinds of resources does your agency have to investigate these types of crimes?
Well, we're the largest tribe in the United States. Obviously, you know, everybody knows we're very large. We have 27,000 square miles of jurisdiction that span 3 states, 11 different counties, and we work, you know, close to several border towns. We have a population of about 180,000, but we only have about 200 patrol commissioned officers policing that whole jurisdiction. The Criminal Investigation Division is actually not under Navajo Police Department. They're a separate division with their own head, which is Michael Henderson. So that's kind of what we're looking at. So we did an assessment recently, and we talked about, a lack of resources. We're severely understaffed. We have a lack of resources. We did an assessment recently with a call load that comes in. We have about 250,000 calls for service every year that come in with only 200 officers. Basically, we need 500 officers just to fill the calls that come in. And that doesn't even include the other programs we're going to do, like a missing and murdered indigenous unit, school resource officers, drug and gang unit. Those kind of things are above and beyond that 500 officers that it just takes to take the emergency calls that come in every day. So we were pretty unique as far as other law enforcement agencies that have their ability to charge federal crime, or not federal crimes, but major felony crimes into state court with their own department. Everything that's a major crime, which basically felonies, kidnappings, homicides, really violent crimes, have to go through the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI. They have to file those charges, and we're not really able to do that because our only authority is to go through tribal court over our own tribal members. So that causes some more jurisdictional issues because we have to work with three different FBI offices, New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona. And they all have their little bit different procedures and different things. And so our criminal investigators and our officers have a lot of collaboration and cooperation they have to do, and communication with a lot of different entities to make sure these cases go forward. And that's what causes problems. Our officers, they investigate these cases as much as they can on the street. Obviously, they have to go to the next emergency call, and it's kind of handed off to the criminal investigators and FBI. And a lot of times, they're understaffed, severely understaffed. The amount of violent crime and things that happen on the Navajo Nation with their large population, that really draws a lot of resources from FBI and investigators, and they're overwhelmed also. So it is really, when it comes down to it, resource allocation problem is part of it. The other part of it was not really addressing the issues of alcohol and drug abuse that kind of are the underlying cause of a lot of these, either the victim or the suspect or somebody involved. Most of our crimes have a nexus connection to alcohol or substance abuse, but that's kind of left unchecked because we don't have the programs in place, the resources to, have intervention programs. And, those left unchecked turn into domestic violence. They turn into other kind of violence. That's where we have a lot of missing people. And I want to just highlight that, there's a lot of missing cases, but they're not all female or children. We have a lot of our male citizens that are missing too. So it's just not a specific, gender problem. It's across the board, and that's all a cause of alcohol and substance abuse issues at the very root of it. So that's kind of our problem and our issues that we have. It's really a resource allocation.
Okay, and yeah, you mentioned some of those social ills and issues that do perpetuate across many communities. But I'd like to understand a response to you on criticisms that law enforcement sometimes dismisses people with a history of domestic violence or substance abuse or has history in sex work. Do you have any response to some of those criticisms against law enforcement?
So as far as my administration and what I've been doing, a crime is a crime and a victim is a victim. It doesn't matter how it happened. We still investigate to its fullest. We investigate completely. We don't take that into account because it doesn't matter what situation or what caused it. They're still a victim and that crime still happened and they still need to be, served justice. So victim blaming is something that we're not tolerating. And we teach that in the academy, and we teach it from the very beginning with these new officers to, be objective and make sure they're investigating and seeing what's in front of them, not the history of the person or their conduct. It's really the crime that happened. So I don't know where that came from. Maybe that's a historical thing in the past, but we really strive ourselves to be professional and make sure we're investigating things fully and not doing that kind of thing, victim blaming whatsoever.
Okay. And Chief Francisco, do you know how many MMIW cases your department is currently handling?
So we did an assessment recently, just kind of did a check of how many missing people cases, and this is men and women together, and juveniles. I think we have about 35 long-term cases total from the 70s, a mixture of, you know, runaways that never came home, some that are unsolved, some that are, and some of those, and here's the interesting thing when you look at it, those numbers are kind of deceiving because some of them, we have to put in the National Missing Person Computer database, and that's where we get it from. But we can't take them out until we actually physically verify that that person's okay. In some of these cases, we've had contact with this missing person, but they refuse to come in or they refuse to go to a law enforcement agency to show that they're okay so they can be taken out. So we have an idea that they're okay, but they don't want to be found, but we can't take them out, so they're still there. A lot of the cases are short-term runaways that come back in a few weeks. Some of them we know they're in hospitals, but because of HIPAA, they won't let us go verify that. So it's interesting that some of these cases that are long-term, we think we know they're okay, but they're refusing to come forward. But some of them are long-term cases that haven't been solved, that have been, you know, cold case basically. So about 35, but we have a lot of reports of it coming in every year. Those are cleared out or are found or resolved very quickly. So that's about what we're looking at right now.
Chief Francisco, we hear about all these different efforts to help with cases of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Reporter Alyssa Bacenti spoke with you recently about how some of that's going for a recent story. Are all those different efforts, are they coordinated well? Or do you see agencies duplicating one another's work?
I see a duplication. You know, they call me into these different groups that are trying to put together a procedure or a task force, and they're all not coordinated with us, and they seem to be working in their own silos. Some of them have overlap, but there seem to be a lot of effort, you know, from the federal government has their own task force. We have the Bureau of Indian Affairs that has a mandate to try to do a task force. Then we have the state agencies. Then you have some of the counties, and then you have, you know, us on the tribe, and then we have, you know, three different ones on the tribe. I think we have our legislative push, and then we have one from the executive branch. Then you have the underground group, not underground groups, but the civilian type groups that are pushing things from that side, which is very helpful. So we have several groups that, you know, they're not really one coordinated effort. It causes some confusion. It causes a lot of my own resource kind of allocation to be part of those, and it's very difficult to manage that. So I do see that quite a bit.
Chief Francisco, thanks again for sharing your experiences. If you can, stick around. We'll ask you of some more questions later on. But we are going to go to our next guest here. Chastity Sandoval is a member of the state's MMIWR task force. She runs the data subcommittee. And she's also a victims advocate with Nambe Pueblo. Good morning, Chastity.
Good morning. How's everybody doing?
We're well, thank you. As we were listening to the chief discuss about duplicated and uncoordinated efforts to address MMIWR, from your position with the data subcommittee, what comes to mind when you hear him discuss those types of issues?
Well, mainly what I have noticed and observation is basically, a lot of modifications needing to be done, a lot of adjustments, a lot of the information that is being entered into the data system does not specify a lot of their, you know, their gender identity as well as their tribal affiliation and their race. So, you know, working on that is very important, and that is something that we had presented as a group. In working with Regina Chacon, who is in charge of the clearinghouse aspect of it. And so if you were to go onto the New Mexico Indian Affairs Department webpage, there's a whole section that is dedicated to the missing and murdered Indigenous women and relatives. Okay. And that gives you the statistic updates as well as the boards and task force members. And also it gives you a whole perspective of graphs and charts that gives you a lot of the stats that has been up to date as of the late 2020 year.
Okay. And from I want to stick more onto the information you have from the subcommittee. Do we know how many people are missing or murdered? Is this something the task force has reliable data on?
Right now, there is not an actual pinpoint number. There is an actual, I guess what we would call that is an estimate, a guess right now. And so what we're doing right now is working on getting a lot of updated information, working with law enforcement, and as well as just talking to tribal leadership and tribal advocates at each reservation in New Mexico. And what we're trying to do right now is get a better informative statistical information on that. And so that is one of the things that we are working on right now. And what we do have as far as right now is I think the estimate was about 55 active cases as of now.
Okay. And you mentioned that the committee has identified data gaps collecting gender and tribal affiliation. Is there anything else that you've identified, and what is needed to fix in those areas?
One thing that we did have noticed is that a lot of the criminal codes and a lot of the ordinances, and as far as a policy and laws in tribal communities, have that lack of addressing issues when a person goes missing. They don't have a proper protocol. And so they don't have that toolkit to help the community what to do when a person goes missing, how to report a person. Do they have a task force that's in charge of that? Who is the law enforcement that takes care of the case from day one, from the beginning? And so that is one thing that we are working on, is to try and figure out how to help tribal communities in New Mexico have a toolkit and that foundation to establish and to work from that. And so that's the important thing, is to make sure that it's in their codes as well as into their protocols, having a system for that.
We're going to take a quick call here from Terry in Albuquerque. Good morning, Terry. Hello, are you with us, Terry?
Hi, yeah, this is Terry.
Hi, what's your comment or question for Let's Talk New Mexico today?
Yeah. I'm calling on behalf of the city of Albuquerque. I'm the city's intergovernmental tribal liaison. And what I wanted to kind of briefly talk about is what the city has been doing in regards to the MMIWR.
You're on the air. Please, you.
Yeah, so the city has been working with the Mexican Affairs Department's task force, with Indian Affairs Secretary Lynn Trujillo. Our staff member out of the Office of Native American Affairs, Don Begay, has been leading the work for the city. And we do understand that it is an epidemic, and we are trying to take every opportunity to raise awareness and push for thorough investigations for every person who goes missing. We understand that the cases sometimes have cross jurisdiction, and each person is a valued member of our community and deserves answers to be brought to light and justice to be served. And the Albuquerque Police Department is stepping up, and Chief Medina, as some of you may know, served as the Laguna Pueblo for years and understands the importance of partisanships with the community, our neighboring Pueblos, tribes, cities, and towns. And we're APD is taking a fresh look at cold cases with some of our most experienced detectives, and they're looking with the help of new forensic technology. One of the individuals that the city is or APD is providing to work with the task force with the Indian Affairs Department is Lieutenant Gerard Bartlett. And what the city is also doing is we're working to develop our own committee that will work with in the community directly. So we have a member of the
Albuquerque American Indian Alaska Native Affairs Commission member, Mr. Kyle Tapaha, Ms. Kim Benali, who will be working with Gerard, and then also a member of the mayor's office, Mr. Aaron Nito. And they're going to be working to develop strategies. And what we're going to be doing is, as we develop these strategies, we'll be working with the community most closely and getting their input on this particular work.
Terry, I want to ask you real quick. We heard from Chief Francisco earlier that there are often a lot of duplicated efforts, a lot of people who are not coordinating very well. What is the city doing to ensure that they're not also repeating that pattern and are coordinating with efforts that already exist?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your question.
Sure. So we have Navajo Nation Police Department Chief Philip Francisco on the show this morning as well. And one of the things he talked about is how a lot of agencies want to help, but they're duplicating efforts, right? So the question I have is, what is the city doing to make sure that that's not happening in this instance as well?
Well, we just recently met with the tribal police chiefs. And so we are coordinating our efforts in regards to working with the tribes also. And so we just held a meeting a couple of weeks ago where we were working with getting more updated information and coordinating. We're creating a coordination of our efforts with the local tribal police chiefs.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in this morning, Terry. We're talking about the long-standing problem of missing or murdered Indigenous people in this region today. Have you ever reported someone missing? What was that experience like? Or maybe you know someone who was found. How important was aftercare to you? And how can people help? Give us a call at 277-5866. Tweet us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM.
The federal government distributed some $200 billion of financial pandemic relief to tribes. One study finds the allocations were less than equitable, with wealthy tribes receiving sums far greater than other tribes with similar enrollment size. We'll find out more on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, two Latinas on how to own your strength inside and outside of the powerlifting gym.
I hesitated going out when they started calling my name, and I didn't want to go out onto the platform. Why am I even doing this? Like, I don't like lifting, and I wanted to quit.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Marisa DeMarco from Source New Mexico, assisting Source reporter and host Sean Griswold in the studio today. Sean, I know this issue has impacted your family too.
Yes, my uncle Arthur Loretto is from Jemez, Zuni, Laguna, Pueblo. He was murdered earlier this year, and his homicide is the only homicide Santa Fe police have not solved this year. So this topic is personal to me, and I appreciate everyone joining us to share their stories.
Thanks for talking about it, Sean. It's so painful to do that, to talk about loved ones who are missing or who've died. But because these cases are not prioritized, relatives are forced to keep advocating for their family members in public. What can be done to ease this burden? We're looking for solutions today, too, and we welcome your ideas. Give us a call this morning at 277-5866.
Okay, so we're now joined by Angel Charlie. She's the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women, a local organization with membership across all of New Mexico. Thanks for joining us, Angel.
Good morning, Sean. Good morning, Marisa. It's great to be here with you.
Excellent. So let's start here. I want to get on the topic of aftercare because people do return home if they do go missing. So would you discuss aftercare about why it's such a significant step in the healing process? And how does your organization support survivors of violence?
Sure. So the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women is a member-led organization. We serve all of the tribes in New Mexico, some urban service providers as well. We work at the intersection of gender-based violence, policy advocacy, community building, training and technical assistance, and education. So part of what we've been advocating for in terms of comprehensive care or wraparound services, if you will, are ensuring that when somebody does return to community, does return to family, that those services are available for them. And what we know right now is that there's a basic lack of services in tribal community and in our border town communities. It's limited. There's wait lists to get in. And so part of how we've been addressing this most recently is advocating, along with the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs, for a $5 million allocation from the state of New Mexico to provide culturally relevant services. We've been working on the federal level with some bigger pieces of legislation implementation, like Savannah's Act, Not Invisible Act, the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act with full tribal provisions, with expand services and coverage of certain issue areas. So just a couple of ways.
Okay. And I'm curious to understand a little bit about this. So how does support shift for Native Americans that live in the city and not in a tribal community? Can federal resources support urban natives?
Sure. So, within the federal system, there are grants and initiatives that do support culturally relevant services. We know that, Albuquerque, for instance, where we're based out of, there is not a service provider who has received the tribal grants funding. And so there's a huge lack. When survivors do access services in Albuquerque, in Farmington, in Gallup, the cities with some of the highest rates of murdered and missing Indigenous women, we know that there aren't culturally relevant services readily available at the larger institutions. But we also know that tribally based programs like 8 Northern Indian Public Council has offices and services here in Albuquerque. But again, those wait lists are long. We've heard up to a 12-month wait to get into state counselor.
Okay, and you mentioned some federal legislation. Savannah's Act and the Not Invisible Act passed by Congress provided greater resources for awareness about MMIWR cases. Would you discuss how this has affected your work and the coalition's work?
Sure. So it's still really early, Sean. They're in the planning phases. They're in the information collecting phases. I think they're really trying to build these out. And when we're thinking about these pieces of legislation, it's important to mention that how they're being kind of implemented right now are on the system side of things. So around data collection, around standardizing forms, around interagency communication between DOJ, DOI, and then all of the programs that fall underneath. Something that's not mentioned in these legislations and that we'll continue advocating for is that piece of family care. This movement, the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women's Movement, started in community. It's a grassroots effort, really at the intersection of extractive industries, fossil fuel industries, and violence against women, particularly sexual violence. And what we've seen is as it gets picked up and taken by system, is that piece is largely left out of the conversation. And so we've done a lot of work to try to reground it in that, ensure that folks are reminded this is where it started, in community, around these real community issues. And we have to keep it there in order for it to hold meaning and community momentum.
Okay. And Angel, one other question. I just would like to understand if you have any specific proposals or ideas that you would like tribal leadership to take on.
Sure, that's a great question, Sean. One of the things that we've advocated for, especially around this issue, is that tribal leaders or representatives have access to all jurisdictional systems. So let's say, for instance, I'm from the Pueblo of Laguna. Someone from my tribe have access to systems in Albuquerque, systems on the federal level, so that that tribal leader or the tribal liaison is able to advocate for a citizen of their own tribe. We haven't seen that. I also think that when tribal leaders or advocates are making their asks, that we are talking about wraparound services, culturally relevant services, for if and when an individual does return to family or community. That piece is being left out of the conversation largely. And so I think those two pieces are extremely important when we're talking about the issue.
Okay, Angel, thank you so very much for sharing with us. We're going to transition now and ask some final questions here. First, I wanted to ask Chief Francisco, if you're still there. Does your department help with support when someone is found, such as transportation to hearings or to connecting them to any other types of services? And can you build can your officers build cases that stand up in court?
Yeah, this is Chief Francisco. So it really depends on where the case is. If it's a federal case that's going through court, the FBI does provide victim services and victim advocates to help them navigate through that process. We do have a lack of resources for tribal courts if there's a victim that's being charged or a suspect or family that's impacted that's going through tribal court. We have limited resources on those type of advocates, but our criminal investigators and our officers will stand by, and the prosecutor's office have some limited resources to help them navigate through the tribal court system. But the federal government really provides those advocates for the major crimes that go through its attorney's office. What was the other part of your question? I'm sorry.
No, actually, you answered the question, sir, so I appreciate that. Thank you, Chief.
We also have APD Chief Harold Medina on the line this morning. Good morning, Chief Medina.
Good morning. How's everybody this morning?
Doing okay. So what's your question or comment for us?
You know, I just wanted to comment, you know, when I retired from APD in 2014, I went on and I became the chief of police out at the Pueblo of Laguna. And upon my return to the city of Albuquerque, you know, I try to stay in contact with the tribes around the metro area. And when I became chief of police, I made it a priority that we meet monthly with the surrounding tribes. And we do have a monthly meeting set up with surrounding tribal agencies because, you know, I caught a little bit of a comment there where, you know, access to databases and access to resources within the city is key. And I know it from both sides. I know what we have in Albuquerque, but I know what the needs are on the tribal side from my time out there. So I just wanted to comment to everybody on the line that we are committed as a department to working with our surrounding tribal agencies. We do have a monthly meeting. And if your police chief isn't involved in these meetings or your police department, just reach out to me, hmedina@cabq.gov. Once again, it's hmedina@cabq.gov, and we'll get you an invitation. Just last month, we walked the chiefs through our real-time crime center, let them know some of our capabilities, and we're consistently striving to improve our relationships because, you know, coming from the tribal side, I know that a lot of times tribal members end up in Albuquerque, and I think it's important we have good, clear communication. So we're committed to helping any way we can, and I look forward to anybody who wants to have their tribal agencies reach out to us.
Chief Medina, I have a question for you. We've been hearing from folks that one of the problems they encounter is that their case is stigmatized, or the person who's gone missing maybe has substance use disorder or has a history of domestic violence, and the officers then treat the case dismissively. We heard that complaint early on in the show about the Albuquerque Police Department. Do you have any response to those concerns from people who are looking for their family members?
You know, if somebody does run into a concern and they have a specific concern, it's easy for me to address. But a lot of times, these larger issues is just a resource. You know, coming from the smaller tribal agency, when I had a missing person report, we were able to, you know, put a lot of resources into it. And all of the departments had a coordinated effort in looking for this individual, checking for this individual. But when you transition to the agency the size of the city of Albuquerque, there's not the resources to give that personalized treatment. And sometimes people see that as disparaging, and they feel that, you know, they're not getting the resources or the services they're expecting. But it's just a matter that you're looking at two different agencies, two different sizes, and the way cases are processed. When I was in Laguna, we were very personable with the community. We had very hands-on approach. We had, you know, I attended village meetings in all six villages. Like, it was a tight-knit community where you got that personalized treatment, like, kind of that's being expected from Albuquerque. Albuquerque is just too big of a city, and you can't expect to get that treatment here. I'd love to give that type of customer service. I'd love us to move in that direction. But a lot of times it's getting one case into the system and working on getting the next case into the system.
But I think what people are often speaking to about these cases, the reason that there's a hashtag, the reason there's a focus on this, is that people feel like people are discriminated against because of their race. Can you speak to any efforts within APD to address that directly or to think about it?
You know, that's one thing that I really learned. And, you know, I learned a lot out at the Pueblo of Laguna. And, you know, one of the things I learned is, you know, and I see it also with other communities, with the Black community, you know, they explain it. And, you know, there is this historical fear and lack of trust with law enforcement or the federal government. And this goes back hundreds of years. And I think that's why it's important. Right now, I'm in the process of working with the University of New Mexico, and Dr. Finney Coleman is working with me. And what I'm trying to do is develop a cultural awareness class that kind of focuses on groups that have mistrust with the community over years upon years. And we want to kind of tell that story so our officers have the background and the understanding of why sometimes there's strained relationships between certain groups in the police department. I think that, you know, I look back over the last 25 years, we've greatly improved our relationships within the community. When I became chief of police, I actually developed a program called the Ambassador Program. And right now, Lieutenant Gerard Butler is assigned as the liaison with the Native American community so that they always have a consistent liaison. We have liaisons with the Black community. We have liaisons with, you know, disabled community. We have a lot of liaisons within the community. And that's one of our first steps is these liaisons kind of working, these ambassadors working.
I am so, so sorry. We are out of time, but we do appreciate you sharing the names of people that people might be able to reach out to if they have these concerns about discrimination.
All right. We're coming to the end of our hour today, but the conversation doesn't end here. Please share your comments with us at KUNM.org or look for Source New Mexico on social media channels like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and be able to connect with Marissa and myself.
There were, you know, I know there's a lot to talk about, and we'll keep prioritizing these cases at SourceNM.com, and we look forward to speaking with you.
And many thanks to our guests today, Shelda Livingston, who's looking for her sister, Pepita Redhair, Darlene Gomez of Advocate for Families, Navajo Nation Police Chief Philip Francisco, Chastity Sandoval, Victims Advocate with Nambe Pueblo, and Angel Charlie, Executive Director for the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women. Thank you, everyone.